Hello, everyone, and welcome along to another podcast of Clarabelle in Conversation with me, Claire Ford, and RNIB Connect Radio. Today on the podcast, I am chatting with Scottish meteorologist and TV weather forecaster Sean Batty. Sean currently works for Scottish Television after previously working at the BBC Weather Centre in London and for BBC Nations and Regions for 3 years between 2004 and 2007. In addition to being a familiar face on our TV screens, Sean is also known for his charity work for the annual STV Children's Appeal, as well as his long association and work with numerous cancer charities over several years. Sean's popularity has also led to him being invited to branch out to front his own TV programmes, one of which is the long-running show Sean Scotland. Sean recently decided a novel way of conquering his fear of heights, to take up flying. Hello, Sean, and welcome to the show. How are you today?
Yes, good. Thanks very much. It's nice to join you, Claire. I wish I could give you better weather at the moment, but yeah, we're doing better than we did in the spring anyway. It was so cold.
Tell me about it. It's lovely to have you on the podcast, and I hope everyone at home enjoys the podcast as well. Sean, since 2007, you've been a daily feature on our TV screens here in Scotland, presenting the weather forecasts on STV. I know that many of my family and friends will not leave the house until they hear what you have to say about the weather. Although I'm bound to say that most of them live in Greenock, so they only really tune in to find out whether the rain is going to be light, heavy or smitty. But tell me, Sean, what first attracted you to the weather? Were the geography lessons at Paisley's Castlehead High School so absorbing that it got you interested in meteorology as a subject?
Well, to be fair, the teachers that I had at Castlehead High were absolutely amazing. And it's funny because one of the teachers actually wanted to be a meteorologist. So when she found out that I wanted to be a weatherman, she was really excited by that. And she had big, long conversations with me about it. But for me, my passion of meteorology actually started when I was about 7 years old. And I actually still have it here behind me. It's a BBC weather kit, which basically is just a weather map with stick-on weather symbols. And I was given that for my seventh birthday. And I used to spend many hours in front of my family sticking these little weather symbols on, doing a weather forecast for them. And then it ended up in my teenage years on the fridge, and I would just update the weather symbols on it every day. So I've had a real passion for meteorology since I was a wee boy, since I was at primary school. And then that just went through high school as well. Talking about the geography lessons at high school, you know, you obviously have all the different subjects you do, and weather is one of them, which was the one that I absolutely adored, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I can remember in class, any questions that ever came up, it was always my hand that was up. I was that kind of teacher's pet at school. And I remember everybody just sitting staring at me, and the teacher trying to avoid me answering every single weather question and showing off. But so my passion for meteorology started when I was a wee boy, and really to this day we don't know what sparked it off. We had a primary school teacher at the time who was really into the environment, and she had us collecting toilet roll tubes. So it might have stemmed from that, potentially.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And you're a huge personality on the TV screen, Sean, bringing the weather to life every day, which is wonderful for us blind and partially sighted people who don't get the benefit of the visual aspect of your job because we either can't see it properly or can't see it at all. My dad tells me, though, that when he was growing up, meteorologists tended to be quite stuffy, white, middle-aged, middle-class men in crimping jackets with badly matched shirts and ties, until Ian McCaskill introduced a more unorthodox way back in the late 1970s. Tell me, Sean, when you were watching weather forecasts growing up, what meteorologists did you watch and what ones did you aspire to be like?
Well, I know you were saying about strange choices of jackets and shirts, and that can sometimes be myself. I mean, we're all still at it. actually, that's a point I should make about that at the moment. I'm colourblind, and so for me, picking out jackets that match shirts can be an absolute nightmare. And before lockdown, as somebody that worked with me that used to come into the wardrobe with me and pick out a jacket that matched the shirt I was wearing that day. But since lockdown, I've been kind of on my own with that. So, yeah, so apologies for any sort of style disasters in the last year. For me, when I was growing up, it was Ian McCaskill, it was Michael Fish. They were the staples at the time. And most of the personalities were on the BBC during that time, with Lloyd Quinnan was presenting the weather on STV. But it was really Michael Fish, Ian McCaskill, Penny Tranter, Rob McElwee. These are some names that some of the older audience will remember. I'm always astonished now. Of course, if I even talk to high school students and talk about Michael Fish, there's just a complete blank look on their face. It's a sign you're getting a lot older. Because, of course, he was such a big, big name. He was an institution in weather. Mm-hmm. So for me growing up, they were the people that I aspired to. They were the people I looked up to. And Heather Reid, Heather the Weather, who was mm-hmm. BBC Scotland's weather presenter at the time. A story actually I've got about her was I wanted to do the weather forecast for a local newspaper, the Paisley Daily Express. And they had said to me, how about we take you to meet Heather Reid and she can maybe give you some tips on how to do a weather forecast. So I went along to meet her. And I mean, at the time I was only, I think 12 or 13. And to meet, I mean, this is like pop star type stuff. I always say it's like always wanting to be, you know, a pop star or you want to be a footballer. For me, this was always my goal, was to be a weather person. And to meet someone who had grown up with Heather Reid, my absolute idol. I don't actually think I spoke much that day. She did all the talking. So it was so good to meet her. And during my school holidays, I used to do the weather forecast for the newspaper, which was a great, great start. And the Paisley Express, always, even until today, whenever they write an article about me, it's always Sean Batty who started at the Paisley Express. So that was the people I grew up watching. And eventually, it was very, very odd because eventually I ended up working alongside these people. They were obviously a lot older. And I was one of the newbies back then. But as you say, you know, I've been at STV nearly 15 years now. The time has just flown. But it's been great fun.
Amazing. And how did you transform this interest that you had developed in the weather and in the subject of meteorology into something that you could possibly pursue as a career?
So I think most meteorologists, most weather people start out just wanting to be a forecaster or a weather observer. And that was what happened with me. So I did all the subjects I needed at school. I wish it had just been geography, but it also had to be good at maths and physics. So I just focused a lot on those. Then I went to Reading University to study meteorology. And at the time, Reading was the only place that you could study meteorology. I think that's changed. In recent years, you can do meteorology subjects, I think, in Edinburgh and Aberdeen and Exeter University, I should say, in the southwest of England. But at the time, I had to go away to Reading. So it was a really scary time for me at the age of 18 to leave home and just be on my own. But it was a great learning curve for me. So I studied meteorology. I left, actually, in my second year, but that was because I was offered a job in the Met Office as a weather observer. So I went on to be a weather observer at a military air base called Middle Wallop, which is in Hampshire. Great name. There was an upper and a lower Wallop as well. So I worked in Middle Wallop. And so I worked there for a year. And then my career just sort of progressed from there. But I never ever set out. I mean, there's always a dream. Like I was saying about footballers and pop stars, there was always a dream that wouldn't it be amazing to be able to be a forecaster on television? Never in a million years ever thought I would do that. So I always thought I would be working behind the scenes, but here we are. And I've been doing it for many years.
And did studying meteorology at university fulfil all your expectations? And was that a course that you really enjoyed?
Yes. Now, I will admit I am a huge what we call weather geek. And do you know, the great thing about it is when I was here and at school talking about weather all the time, I mean, for most other, you know, kids at school and everything, that's just boring. I mean, that's not fun. But when I went away to university, it was great to be around like-minded people and, you know, share accommodation with people that, you know, loved meteorology as well. And we all had a passion for it. And, you know, when it snowed, we were all outside, really excited. When there was flooding, we would all go away and, like, get our wellies and go to the flooding. So it was great to be amongst people that were into it as well. And at one point, I actually shared accommodation with a guy called Reid Timmer, who actually is really well known even here in Scotland. He was from Oklahoma. So he came from Oklahoma University and he was a tornado chaser. So he was just so, he was crazy. He was just absolutely crazy. and he was a tornado chaser and now he runs his own tornado chasing company in Oklahoma. And I still stay in touch with him. But as I say, studying at Reading, it was great. It's just so good to be with other people. And the course, obviously, it was my absolute passion. So it was great to be doing a meteorology course.
You then went on to work at the BBC Weather Centre in London for 3 years. And whilst you were there, you became a relief weather forecaster as well as being a broadcast assistant, covering in the nations and regions of the UK for presenters that were off. Can you tell us how the opportunity arose for you to present the weather at the BBC, Sean?
Yeah, so as you say, I started off as a weather observer, worked at ITV for, I think, about a year, working behind the scenes with people like Shan Lloyd. Many people remember Shan as well. Then went to the BBC. Initially starting off at the BBC as a radio presenter, so I used to cover lots of the different radio, Radio Oxford, Wales, you know, three counties. It was all over England mostly. And then at one point they just said, would you like to have a go at TV? Would you like to do a screen test? Of course, I jumped at the chance. And when I was doing my first screen test, Michael Fish was there. Now, remember, this was a guy that I'd grown up watching my whole life and aspired to be. But there was somebody there at the time called Daniel Corbett, Dan Corbett. He was completely out there. He had a very unique style of doing the weather, which I loved. It was a really excitable style. He used to say things like, come on, let's get the cranes out and draw the weather map. You know, he was so much fun. So I stylized myself on him. So I stood up to do my screen test and Michael Fish just looked at me and said, I don't think you'll ever present for the BBC. You're far too ITV for us. But I did. I went on to present the BBC weather, as you say, for many of the regions. So I used to just live out of a suitcase for about 3 years. I travelled around. I presented the weather at most of the English regions, the Channel Isles, Look North. I presented also BBC Wales, BBC Northern Ireland. So I presented pretty much all the English regions, the nations of Wales and Northern Ireland. I'd never ever conquered Scotland. I'd never got to present for the BBC in Scotland. So I was always desperate to be able to come home and present, but it wasn't for the BBC.
That must have been an incredible achievement for you to fulfil that dream of presenting the weather. And do you know what? It definitely did stead you in good shape for what you were about to do next, Sean, because they say that us Scots are like salmon, in which we eventually return home to the land of our birth. And you did exactly that, and you got to fulfil that dream of presenting in Scotland when you took up a post at STV almost 15 years ago. Can you tell us how the opportunity came around for you to present the weather at STV, Sean, and most importantly, to return home?
Well, as I said, my career started off in media, I suppose, with radio at the BBC, and I can remember way back, the very, very first broadcast I ever did was for BBC Radio Leeds, and it was at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I can remember my, you know, gran and grandpa, mum and dad were so excited about this. So they all got up super early, tuned in, and they were so over the moon by just hearing me on the radio, and they were like, oh my goodness, you know, this is, you know, you've reached your goal. And and then obviously that moved on to television, which was great for my family to be able to see me moving to that next stage. But now when I talk to my mum and I say, oh, what did you think of the forecast the other day? Or she'll, oh, I never saw it. You know, it's just, it's become so normal for them now that I'm on the television. And quite often I think they miss me. Hopefully they're not watching the other channel, mind you. But so, like you say, I came back to Scotland, which was amazing because the opportunity had come up at STV. Now, STV used to have weather presenter, as I mentioned earlier, Lloyd Quinnan, and they also had somebody else called Karen Greenshields. They stopped their weather presenters back in the 90s, so they had had a gap for about 10 years where they didn't have anybody doing the weather apart from the newsreader just reading a script at the end of the STV news. So they had a new head of news that really wanted to have a presence for weather. And apparently they had been out and they had done interviews and screen tests and they couldn't find anybody that was suitable for it. I was lucky that the head of news had contacted ITV in London and said, is there anybody Scottish, you know, that would, you know, potentially be able to do the weather for us? And they said, well, there's somebody who used to work for us who now works for the BBC. He's currently in Northern Ireland. You should drop him a line. So, yeah, that was that, really. Head of news contacted me and said, we'd love you to come over, meet us, because we're looking for a new presenter. So I walked in the door, spoke to them. I mean, it was the most informal interview I've ever done because they had already seen what I was doing in Northern Ireland. And they just said, yeah, so when could you start? So yeah, handed my notice in at the BBC, and it was so exciting. I hadn't conquered Scotland at the BBC, but finally I got to come back home and bring my passion of weather back to Scotland, back to, well, where I always wanted to be back. You know, England and being down south is great. I mean, the weather's a lot better, but it's nice to be closer to my family here. And my passion is Scotland and meteorology.
Fantastic. And it must have been a great feeling for you to return home, because as you've said before, you are a home bird, really. But I remember the first time I saw you on the TV all them years ago, and honestly, it feels like yesterday. It's just, it's crazy how time flies. We, the viewers, only get to see the finished product of a weather forecast, Sean. Can you actually tell us what goes into making and producing weather forecasts?
So there's, I always say that the stuff I do in the studio is like 5% of my day-to-day job. The amount of taxis I've jumped in and, you know, the driver said to me, right, so what else do you do? And I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's like, because they think, you know, I must have another job. I mean, you can't just do the weather. I mean, that's not a full-time job. It is. and at STV, actually, I do 21 weather broadcasts a day. I'm on the TV 21 times a day, but generally, most people that are watching will only catch, say, the evening bulletin, or they'll catch the lunchtime one, so they don't see all the other ones I do. And the reason I do so many is all 21 of those are not just on our channel. STV split into three regions. So there's like the north of Scotland, there's the east, which covers Fife and Edinburgh, and then there's the west, which is like Fort William to Girvan. So I do a weather forecast for each of those. And the funny thing about that is that wherever I travel around the country, so if I'm, say, in Shetland, people say, so where is it in Aberdeen you live? Or, you know, if you're in Fife, they'll think you live in Edinburgh. But it's because I'm doing a forecast and talking to their newsreaders that they think that I'm in all these different parts of the country. So to put a weather forecast together, which this is my new little office. I now work from home, and it looks like I'll be doing that for the foreseeable now, because we've realised that actually still works. So in the morning, I log in. I've got a login to get into the Met Office. I get to look at all the Met Office's computer models, what they're forecasting over the next 24 hours. And with all things weather, and this is always our fallback as weather people, is meteorology isn't an exact science, so when we get it wrong, it's a science. And you know, when I log in the morning, you look at the computer model, but you kind of have to interpret what the computer model is trying to show. You can't take it literally because it would be wrong. So my job's really to interpret the data, make it sort of easy to understand, because sometimes the weather situations in Scotland, you know what it's like, Claire. It's like one minute it can be snowing, the next minute it can be raining, next minute it's lovely sunshine. It's our country has some of the most volatile weather in Europe, so it can be really tricky sometimes. But so I look at these charts and then I prepare the graphics that are on the television. But as you've mentioned earlier on, what I always try and do is try and make the weather, you know, something that for people that have, you know, visual impairments, when I'm doing the weather, I try to be quite descriptive about what's happening and try and talk a lot about all the things that are going on. Like I've referred to low pressures as roly-polies of cloud, or, you know, I try and make it so that it's visual for people to be able to kind of see it in their head. And I hope that kind of comes across sometimes.
Such a fantastic process, and you honestly deserve a medal with the four seasons in one day, having to cope with that, having to process that every day. It can't be easy.
Only get it wrong a few times.
It's amazing. So many people rely heavily on your weather forecast, Sean, from people boarding aircraft to long-distance lorry drivers to sailing enthusiasts to golfers to people going out on their daily walk and wanting to know whether it'll be interrupted by a downpour. Do you feel the weight of expectation to get the weather forecast spot on is a bit too stressful at times?
Well, it can be. And, you know, as I said, the Scottish weather is so fickle, it's very volatile. And we in the northeast of Scotland have an awful lot of microclimates. So, you know, you might have heavy rain just west of Aviemore, and then, you know, somewhere like Banff or, you know, Aboyne in Aberdeenshire has brilliant sunshine, really high temperatures. So it can be really complex. But for me, my job becomes much more important when we have a big storm, which of course we give lovely names nowadays, like Roger and Fleur, and not very stormy names on certain occasions. But that's when my job becomes really important, because I feel then that I'm informing people, keeping people safe, hopefully giving people advice that will save some lives. For example, you know, when we are battered in Scotland by some huge storms, places like Orkney and Shetland and the Western Isles are just so exposed to these storms and tidal surges. So when we get times like that, it's very exciting for me, but it's also just makes my job much more important. And it can be a big weight on your mind that you hopefully have done your absolute utmost to inform people of severe conditions. Because unfortunately, of course, there was a family washed away in one of the storms in the Western Isles and one of the causeways years ago. And I mean, it's trying to avoid tragedy like that. But fingers crossed that, you know, I do give enough information. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, Scotland is just, can I put my washing out today or not? Mostly not, but that's what most people generally need and want. And luckily that's, you know, severe weather that is life-threatening is fairly rare here.
Yeah. I mean, you're lucky that you don't find it too stressful for yourself. And infamously in October 1987, poor old Michael Fish was vilified after he dismissed a woman's warning that a hurricane was heading for the UK. What was about to hit wasn't a hurricane, but with gusts of winds up to 134 miles per hour, it was hurricane force. It caused major havoc, causing planes and vehicles to overturn, ferries to run aground, blowing over trees and killing 18 people in the process. And Michael Fish and Bill Giles told the country that it was insignificant and it would pass well south of the UK. Whoops. Have you ever had a situation, Sean, where you've gotten the weather forecast spectacularly wrong? Or is the science of meteorology and weather forecasting too accurate these days for that to happen?
Well, in Michael Fish's defence, he was on that occasion called in because he wasn't supposed to actually be presenting that evening. Somebody had phoned in sick, so unfortunately he ended up in that position. And in those days, in the 80s, I mean, it's much slight to say that was just a few years ago. It was a long time ago. And, you know, technology has advanced so much. If you ever get the chance, if you're ever down in Exeter, you should definitely try and go on one of the Met Office visits. The supercomputer they now have almost takes up the whole of the bottom floor of the Met Office. The computer is so vast. And it is now so big that it's outgrown the building they're in. They're in this massive building. They're now building a new place nearby, which is going to house yet another huge computer, which its job is just to store the observations and data we've had over the last 100 or so years. So we have these huge supercomputers that are getting better and better all the time. And we actually say since the 1980s, what we would have been able to forecast with good accuracy back in the 1980s would have been a one-day forecast. But now we could accurately forecast and we have good confidence for day one, two, and three. Whereas in the 80s, beyond day two, I mean, it's educational guesswork. But it's, you know, things have advanced so much that we are in a much better position. And things like Michael Fish, unfortunately, you know, we follow computer models. The computer models sometimes get it wrong, and then we then get it wrong as well. And also things have changed. The way media get their weather forecasts nowadays, for example, well, the BBC until quite recently got their forecasts from the Met Office. They still take some of their data from the Met Office. ITV and STV, we use the Met Office and also Channel 5. So when you get lots of people, lots of different channels using the same company, the Met Office, for the weather data, we're all saying roughly the same thing, which is good because it means if we get it wrong, we all get it wrong. but generally that will not happen. A 24-hour forecast should not go badly wrong, spectacularly wrong. However, there has been odd occasion, and forecasting snow is absolutely notorious in Scotland. You know, if you get snow in Russia or Canada, the temperature's like minus 15, minus 10. You know what's coming, it's going to be snow. Here in Scotland, our temperature is usually about 1 or 2 degrees. So you're on that, what just the cusp of it either being rain or snow. But you always err on the side of caution and say, you know, well, there is the possibility of 10 centimetres of snow. And then I wake up to a barrage of abuse on Twitter the next day because they're saying, where's the snow? It's just been raining. And that has happened on a few occasions.
I know. You're only human. You're only human. Exactly. And I think everybody, will get it wrong every so often. But, I mean, it's amazing you've managed to get it mostly right in your career so far.
It's funny you say, because the Sun newspaper actually did a story going back about 8 years ago or something, when Heather Reid was still at the BBC. And that was the funny thing, because Heather Reid and I ended up almost sort of rivals, even though, you know, I'd grown up and had met her when I was a teenager and we worked in opposite channels. it's funny because, yeah, just what ended up happening between, you know, that she was there and I was at STV. So, yeah.
Mm, yep. And poor old Trish Williamson, God rest her soul, got it in the neck really badly from Jimmy Greaves for failing to predict the great storm of 1987. To be fair to Trish, though, she was a weather presenter and had nothing to do with the science of meteorology. As a qualified meteorologist yourself, does it irk you sometimes when TV companies will sometimes employ people to present the weather due to the way they look rather than their knowledge of meteorology?
Controversial stuff. Nowadays, I actually don't think that you need a weather background to work in meteorology on television. It is beneficial because, you know, on occasions when we get severe storms or something goes wrong, it's good to have a weather background and be a meteorologist, because then you're able to explain it. You're able to put things in layman's terms because you have an intricate understanding of meteorology science, the way it works, the what we call probabilities, because weather is not always, you know, we have a 100% chance of winds reaching this on the Western Isles. Generally, it's winds, you know, we've got a 60, 70% chance that winds could reach that. And it's only really if you understand meteorology and weather that you're able to put that in a way that people can understand. Because I think my job is trying to make things easy enough for a viewer to understand. And because our viewers just need key points. They don't need the sort of science and the, oh, there's a possibility that this might happen, but there's also a possibility that could happen, but there's a more chance that this could happen, because that just makes things really confusing. So I think it's beneficial, but not necessary. And, you know, when I get people writing to me and saying, you know, I'd really love to be a weather person, how do I go about it? Well, there are so many avenues into it. And it doesn't always necessarily mean that you need to have a meteorology or weather background. As I said, it does help, but, you know, the Met Office can give you briefs and you can just say what you want. I don't really get briefs from the Met Office because I kind of understand it enough that, you know, it's up to me to say what I want to say, but it's open for everybody, I think.
I suppose that's the same with all jobs, really, and everything. I mean, I remember in school they always used to say, you know, you don't need to get qualifications to be successful. There's always different ways of doing it. And I think that is, that really, really rings true with that.
A lot of jobs are like that now, though, aren't they? They're, degrees used to be so, so important for, you know, getting a job. And it was always seen that to succeed, you needed a degree, which is, it's rubbish. You know, you can succeed and you can achieve, like, your dream job. And you know, you potentially don't have that degree, you don't need it. Because a lot of it comes down to just experience and working in the industry and you can I suppose be mentored. So yeah, I mean, if you should follow your dreams, if you have a dream job you want to do, then just follow the dream.
Absolutely, nothing should stop you. And incidentally, Sean, is there a type of weather that meteorologists tend to like, or is it in the job description for you to like all kinds of weather?
I'll admit to you that there are probably about 3-4 months in the summer, 3-4 months around sort of late winter, early spring, which actually I find really boring. Weather people tend to end up in the job because they, you know, their interest has been sparked by, you know, a love of storms or a love of snow. Mine is definitely a love of snow and cold weather. People will probably hear the excitement in my voice whenever it's the winter and we've got snow and cold weather in the way, because that I'm a big weather fan of cold and snowy weather. But there are points in the year where I think the weather is just, for us meteorologists, can just be really boring, and we spend weeks talking about a little bit of drizzle here, a little bit of sunshine there, temperatures nothing to party about, you know, 13-15 degrees, and that can be a real struggle, just having weeks and weeks and weeks of that. You know, Scotland's probably one of the few places in the world where, you know, the winter solstice in December can be, you know, 14 degrees and raining, and the summer solstice in June can also be 13 degrees and raining. So our weather doesn't really change overly much, but I don't like it being static for too long. I don't like long, dry spells, because that just gets boring after a while, and I don't like long wet spells. So we like the volatility of weather, the things that other people don't like.
Yeah. It is interesting, but I suppose that's why he's going to the job, because he's love it so much, and there's nothing like a bit of drama. That's what I always say anyway. So,
oh, definitely. And I love drama. That's why I watch every soap on television.
And how has lockdown and the restrictions, we spoke about it a bit earlier on, affected the way that you have presented the weather within the last year and made weather forecasts, Sean?
Everybody's had to find new ways of working in the last year. For me, I decided when, I mean, isn't it strange when you think back to just over a year ago, we were told to sing happy birthday and just wash your hands. And, you know, and it went to the point, you know, where we weren't really supposed to leave the house. And obviously that meant things had to really change. Now, working in news broadcast, I'm actually an essential worker, which might sound really odd because why is it absolutely essential that you get the weather forecast? Well, I suppose, you know, it gives you information and potentially that could be important information when we've got bad weather. So a couple of weeks before we went into official lockdown, I went to the bosses and said, look, I'm not happy with this. I'm just going to start working from home. And nobody really knew how I was going to be able to do this. But I decided just to use my iPhone, and I got a little microphone and a light, and I just started presenting from the back garden. So I was doing all the broadcasts from the back garden, sending them into work. And yeah, it went down an absolute storm. Everybody seemed to really like it. And I did that from March right through to, I think it was about September, October. And do you know the amount of people I meet nowadays that come up to me and say, oh, I just loved when you presented from the garden, because I got to introduce people to just all the things that happen and change in our garden through the year. From, you know, when I look back at the early broadcasts and you look at the garden and there's like nothing out at all, the garden looks really bare, right through till, you know, summer and as the flowers are out, the trees are in full leaf. And into the autumn, and I was able to introduce, you know, I've got a little bird box, it's got a camera in it, so I was introducing people to the little bird box. Then the hedgehogs arrived in the autumn, which was just really nice, and I suppose it kind of related to what most people were doing at the time. They were at home and they were starting to observe things that were happening around them a lot more than they ever have. You know, the amount of wee animals that I've seen in the garden that I wouldn't normally have seen because I would have been at work. You know, I'm still working at home. I do go into the studio every day, but I'm only in there for an hour to do the broadcast. Mm-hmm. And then I come back home because I can do everything at home. And, you know, that'll be the way for a lot of people. And my plan is just to continue working at home and get into the studio. And, you know, I will be there longer on some occasions. But, yeah, it's a complete change. ITV, I know they continue to go into the studio. But I decided that, yeah, we would do it from home, and people really, really enjoyed that, which was great. And we had the Mini Met team come up with this idea. A lot of parents were trying to like teach their kids on their own, mm-hmm. homeschooling. So I decided that I would start a little Mini Met team and give the parents some weather stuff for the kids to do. And that just took off, and we ended up with about 1,000 children involved by the end of it, which was really, really good.
And it's certainly, I really, really enjoyed it as well, just seeing you at home. It's just something different, I think, as well, because mm-hmm. I think everybody expects people to be in the studio, as you say. But I think everybody has realised that you can do it in various ways, which is fantastic. So
just more informal, like, you know, I sometimes just think things are too stuffy still on television, you know. I mean, okay, we're not still wearing bow ties, and there are people that are upset that I'm no longer wearing a tie, and that was a decision that I kind of took, because being much more relaxed, it's normal. I do hope that people like that it's yeah, it's just normal. It's just me and the garden, or it's just me in the studio, you know, quite relaxed about it. I think that's a better way to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think everybody is going to be the new normal, working from home and all that. And it's brilliant that everybody's kind of thought about that and thought about different ways of doing it. So it's fantastic. Now, Sean, in addition to your work as a weather presenter, you've also brought us some very interesting weather-related programmes, such as Weather Watch and the excellent show Sean Scotland, as well as branching out to front the Scottish Children's Lottery draws, Sean's Festive Scotland and Sean's Very Scottish Ogmanay, which all brought in top viewing figures, may I add, for STV. Can you tell us how the opportunity came around for you to diversify and expand your TV presenting skills?
Gosh, you know, it's funny when you were going through the list there, I forgot that I did all those different things like Weather Watch. Gosh, that was a long time ago. And that was the first sort of have a go at doing something other than the television weather forecast. I went off to Iceland and did a programme there. I think it was a two-part programme, which did pretty well. But the Sean Scotland stuff that we did recently ended up becoming a massive hit. It was STB's highest-rated regional programme for a good few years. You know, there's always a real nervous. You'll know that they like to put the name Sean into the programmes. You know, Sean's Best of Scotland, Sean's Hugmanay, Sean's Scotland. And... you know, see when your name's in a programme, it makes you so nervous because it kind of makes you feel that if it goes wrong or it doesn't rate very well, that people don't like you. I mean, it's so difficult to take things like this, you know, not to take it personally. So when the ratings were so high, I was quite glad. It was like a sort of endorsement. But really, these things... I mean, Weather Watch a good few years ago only came about, and you might laugh at this, but the scheduler said, "Oh, we've got 2 half-hour slots that we're opting out of ITV for something. We just, you know, we kind of need to fill them. What can we do? Let's, you know, Sean can do a Weather Watch program." But there was a lot more commitment when it came to Sean Scotland to actually make a series. As I said, that has ended up to be really successful. The Sean's Hugmanay. I'd grown up again as a wee boy. It's bred into us, Scottish people, isn't it, that New Year is such a big thing. Hugmanay is, you have this routine at Hugmanay that you get yourself, you're showered and all freshened up in the evening and you get your good clothes on, even though you're just sitting in front of the telly. And to be offered to do that, to bring the New Year in for the channel was just... I actually would say that's even above the meteorology stuff and being a weather person, because it's so iconic in Scotland. It's such a big thing to be able to say you've done. The unfortunate thing was, and at the time I thought, isn't that great? I'm bringing in 2020. Like, 2020, it's such an easy year to remember, you know, that I brought 2020 in for the channel. But also, I'll remember it because it was an absolute disaster of a year, wasn't it, 2020? So... the one year I got to bring in for the channel, and it was it rated well, but yeah, the year wasn't that great. But hopefully, if I'm ever asked to do it again, we won't have another year like that. But yeah, it's been great to kind of be asked to do more programming, and also with Sean Scotland, it's not hard work when you're out and about. It's like a holiday. It's like, you know. I say it's like a holiday. I remember Wish You Were Here. I remember all the holiday programmes years ago. And people used to say, oh, imagine, that would be great, you know, out there and they're travelling all over the world. But actually, they're only there for a few hours. And that kind of is the case with us. But, you know, I get to spend a week in places like Colonsay, the Western Isles. You know, we've been to just so many places. And, I mean, that's great. I mean, to be able to do that, it's like having a little holiday and making a programme at the same time.
That's definitely something I want to do. It's on my bucket list to travel around Scotland as well. Absolutely. Yeah. But, yeah.
Honestly, there's when the sun shines, and I know people say this all the time, when the sun shines, there's just like, there's nowhere else like it. One of the things I remember was when we were in Colonsay. I mean, we were so lucky the week that we went up there. It was an absolute swelter. I got up before everybody else and I just ran into the sea in the morning to have a open water swim. And it was just, I mean, the sky didn't have a cloud in it. The water was, it's just so clear. You could see right down to the bottom. And I mean, Colonsay, if you've ever been, it's an empty place. I think there's only like, you know, 100 odd people that live there, but it was so weird because there were so many times I had to go, this is Scotland, this is actually our own country, this is on our doorstep. And I mean, we just don't explore our own country enough, but I expect a lot more people will be doing that this year.
Phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. And do you have anything in the pipeline presenting wise for us to look forward to, Sean?
Well, I would like to say that Sean Scotland was going to come back. It was supposed to come back last year. Obviously, it didn't. We've talked about socially distant Sean Scotland. I'm not quite sure how the format of that would work. So it is on the shelf at the moment, but I'm pretty confident that hopefully within the next year there will be another series of the programme. So I'll say no more than that just now, but my hope is that we will have another Sean Scotland series soon.
Fantastic, fingers crossed. And I know, Sean, from watching Sean Scotland, that you share my passion for our beautiful country, Scotland. Can you tell us how the love affair and the love of travelling around Scotland first began for you? Do you think that, as we spoke about earlier, being away in the early part of your career and for university triggered those feelings of love for your country when you returned?
Everybody that moves away becomes like an expat, hankers for home. And, you know, you talk to people that have moved to Spain or that live down south, and they end up with this sort of fuzzy idea of what home is. And then they come home and it just rains relentlessly and they think, actually, I'm better than I was before. I've always had a passion for Scotland, and even more so after coming back. And I used to actually come back every winter when I was living down south. I would come back every winter and I would travel around Scotland. Way back, you used to be able to get a dinner, bed and breakfast for like £20 at most hotels in Scotland. And that was a great way to get around the country cheaply. So I used to do that in the winter. But the Sean Scotland has allowed me to visit lots of places that I would never have gone before. As I said, Colonsay. And it just so happens that I booked to go back to Colonsay in September because I enjoyed it so much that I just want to go back, but this time for a pure holiday. Mull, a place I've never been. Again, I want to go back on a holiday. Some of the stuff we did in Mull, we swam with the seals there. And we were coming back in the boat and there was a pod of probably about 100 dolphins all around the boat, jumping out of the water. And, we went over to see the puffins. There's just so much to see and do on our own doorstep. And it is absolutely stunning. And if you can time it with good weather, it makes it even better. Just try and avoid midgy season, because when I was filming, the worst Sean Scotland I filmed was in Arran, and it was August, I think. And oh my goodness, honestly, there was a couple of the days we nearly abandoned filming because the midges were just so bad. it's a shame we've got that blight in this country, but if we get a good long, dry, sunny spell, they're not as bad.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been just amazing just getting that opportunity to travel around the country for it. I would love to do that. I would just love to just travel all the time. I just love traveling altogether. So, you know,
yeah. Being in this position has just given me so many opportunities that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And I wish, you know, I could share like so much more of it. Like, even things like the appeal, when I've been involved in that, I've done a tie-up with Loganair. And Loganair get us to all the different places. Like, I've done fundraising in Shetland and Orkney, on Isla. You know, they've allowed me to go into the cockpit to sit in the jump seat. And, I mean, that is just... I mean, that's not something that people get to do anymore. I mean, that used to be a thing you could do years ago. But all the opportunities and... that you get from it, it's incredible. And the good thing with Sean Scotland is that I'm able to sort of show Scotland off to everybody and give everybody inspiration for trips and holidays around their own country.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear how enthusiastic and grateful you are for the opportunities that you get. I mean, it's very, 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 very inspiring itself. We've heard through the podcast how busy you are in your career, Sean. Can you tell us what you do to relax and unwind?
Relax? I don't know the meaning of the word. For me, I think a lot of people in the last year have had their own struggles with, you know, mental health become a big thing. A lot of people have had some big struggles over the year, and I think there's been a realization that we've all been going too fast. And What I think is quite sad is that, you know, the world slowed down during lockdown, and we're not quite back to the way we were. But, you know, we're back to this whole, you know, you go out on the road and the roads are busy and there's people with road rage and there's just, and you just think, oh gosh, wasn't it so nice when it was just slower? I mean, I certainly loved, I mean, obviously there was this, you know, jobs and things been lost, which is terrible. But it's just to have that slower pace of life has been good. And it's given me time to think. So during lockdown, I decided to start woodwork. And so I've started cutting wooden maps. There's so many new things I've taken up. I made wreaths at Christmas and I put it on our local Facebook page and I ended up with 115 orders for wreaths. So I ended up making, and they weren't all small ones. Some of them were like huge garage door ones. So I made them and I sold them off and I used the money to give to the Renfrewshire Toy Bank. So I love any sort of escapism, which is me doing and making stuff. I get so much out of doing that, you know, coming up with an idea and making something. And I've bought myself a laser cutter that now cuts wood out for me. So I'm planning on doing lots of Christmas things, maybe getting a stall somewhere and selling it. So, I've taken up all these new hobbies. And one that you might already know about is flying, which obviously went on the back burner because I didn't want to be too close to an instructor inside a tiny little plane in the last year. Mm-hmm. But I haven't done that for the last year, but I'm hoping to get back to it. Mm-hmm.
And on that subject, you obviously, with the flying, you've got an aim to get your private pilot's licence. Is this so that you can get up to the clouds to study them more closely, or is a love of aircraft simply from growing up in Paisley so close to Glasgow Airport?
Yeah, I think that certainly is one of the reasons. I think growing up in Paisley, I can remember Mum and my granddad always taking me down to the airport whenever Concorde came in. And that was such a big thing. It was such a big deal. It used to only come in around about Christmas time, I think. And we used to go and watch it taken off. And I lived in Foxbar at one point. Those that know Foxbar, like listening, Morar Drive, which is a spectacular place to be because it's really high up and you get a great view across the whole of the West Central Belt. And you get a great view of the planes. I had a pair of binoculars on my window ledge, so I used to watch planes coming and going. But I actually, the main reason that I get into flying is because I have an absolute fear of flying. I am absolutely petrified of it, to the point where, you know, when I'm getting on a plane sometimes, I think before the doors shut, before the stewardess has closed the door, I'm sitting thinking, right, I can still get out, I could still get off this plane if I want. And then the door closes and then the plane starts getting pushed back and my heart's pounding and I'm thinking, I don't think I can get off now. I don't think I could actually say to them, I want it off. So for me, that's why I ended up flying. I mean, that might sound really stupid, but one day I just said, I'm going to go for a flying lesson, see what it's like. In the tiny aircraft, it's 100 times bumpier. It's the little planes are like 40, 50 years old, maybe a little bit rusted in parts. And, you know, you go, I have absolute faith in them. And the reason for that is because I've now learned a lot more about flying. I mean, it's bonkers, isn't it? When you look at the Emirates plane, the big A380, when it comes into Glasgow, you think, how on earth? I mean, think of the number of people that are on there, the number of bags, the number of crates. How does that get there, the plane itself? But obviously, it's all down to science. But I mean, it's so bamboozling. So I decided to learn to fly, and I now have real confidence in the wee planes. I absolutely love it. You know, fly down to Prestwick, and you can even put the engine to idle, which basically means the engine's not really doing anything. And you can glide these planes for a long, long way. They're just gliders, really. So I've got a lot more confidence, but when I get in a big passenger plane, I'm still petrified.
I mean, I can totally identify with that because I know my mum, she's absolutely terrified of flying. Not so much landing and when she's up in the air, but takeoff, she absolutely hates takeoff. But with myself, I'm the total opposite. I find it the most exhilarating thing ever. I absolutely love flying, yeah. So I totally get where my mum's coming from as well and where you're coming from too.
I mean, the takeoff for me is, yeah, I hate it because it's the beginning of the journey. the flying, the level of flying, I'm thinking, I'm sitting counting down the hours. The landing, I'm like, yep, this is good. We're nearly there. That's my three stages of flying.
But that's amazing how you're able to, you know, just take up flying lessons to help you to overcome at least a bit of it, which is, I mean, I think that's phenomenal. That's a phenomenal thing. And I think
it's any fear, really, I suppose, isn't it? It's just facing it. I mean, don't ever ask me to pick up a spider, but I'll do flying.
That's amazing. And we spoke a wee bit earlier on about the appeal and about the thing that you did for Loganair and stuff. And that's one of the other things that you're known and loved for here in Scotland, Sean, is your work as an ambassador for the STV Children's Appeal. You've taken up punishing hikes, walks, cycles and runs in aid of the charity. Can you tell us a bit about the appeal, please? And also, can you feel free to plug this year's appeal while you're at it?
We've been around since 2011, the STV Children's Appeal, and I just decided to throw myself right into it to become part of it, and I've ended up, as you mentioned, an ambassador. And, you know, several million pounds has been raised in that time, and the money comes from proceeds of crime. The Scottish Government are able to match fund a lot of the money. And it is to help children in Scotland out of poverty. And, you know, I was brought up in Paisley, you know, we've lived in Falkirk as well. There's poverty everywhere, and I naively have always thought that poverty in Scotland is a central belt thing. You know, west central Scotland, you can certainly see we've got a lot of it here. But it's everywhere. You know, even places that you think are, you know, like in Aberdeen, where there's all the oil money, where, you know, Shetland, which has also got oil money as well. There's a lot of very rich people in these places, but there's also an awful lot of people living in terrible poverty in Scotland as well. It's you just don't expect it. And it's not always poverty in the way we think, oh, you can't eat. Sometimes it's just that some kids just don't have the support from family that they need. One of the projects I went and visited was a group where the kids got to meet other kids at the end of the day after school. They got a meal. And there were volunteers there to help them do the homework. And I thought, but why can't these kids go home? And like, what is it? I didn't really understand it. But the reason was because their parents were perhaps out. They had drink problems, drug issues. And the children weren't being cared for properly. So, you know, this group was set up to help them with homework and make sure that they had a hot meal. And it's things like that that just make you think, God, you know, I've got to be involved in this. I've got to do my bit and try and get more kids out of poverty. So I've done so many things. And again, that's opened up opportunities like getting to sit in the cockpit with the pilots. And, you know, I cycled the Western Isles for the appeal. I've cycled Shetland. I cycled Orkney. I've cycled Glasgow to Edinburgh several times, Pedal for Scotland, which some listeners I expect I've done in the past. I've done kilt walks, climbed Ben Nevis, I've swum different places. It's just so many things over the years, but I think every little bit helps, and it's great to see the appeal has become bigger and bigger and more people have got behind it. You know, we now have hundreds and hundreds of people that support us from all over the country, which is, it's great to see because it's helping people in our own country.
Absolutely. And it's turning a negative into a positive, which is absolutely fantastic, especially this year of all years as well. I mean, I think the appeal definitely will help more than ever. And it's more vital than ever to raise money for it. So I think it's incredible. And it's something that I watch every year anyway. So I see, you know, firsthand, you know, the kind of impact that these things have. And it's something that needs to change, but we're getting there with it.
It's horrible. Just some, you know, you hear some of these the stories behind why we're doing it, and you know, it makes it all worthwhile. And the more and more people that can get behind it, the better.
Absolutely. And I know from watching Shaun Scotland as well, as you mentioned earlier on, you spoke about being colourblind. You spoke about, obviously, choosing your clothing and things like that, how it affects that. But does it also affect the way that you make and produce your weather forecasts?
It does, because we use some wide and varied and wild colours with our computer models to show changes in temperature, to show intensity of precipitation, to show, I mean, so many things that wind speeds are shown in colours for us on the computer models. So it's quite difficult. What I tend to find is usually there's one colour that I can at least identify. And you know, you would get a scale next to it. So I go, okay, so that's like white. I know that's white. So there's white. And then I go, I can see there's a change of colour there. There's a change of colour there. So then I work my way up the scale. So that's kind of the way I've managed to work around it. But I have also said to the Met Office, it'd be good if there was a colourblind version of all these things. But I don't really know how they could do that. They have done things like, you know, instead of, like, they've done models that have got dots and crosses and bars just to kind of try and show you different things. But generally, everything we do is in colour. And going back to the flying, I can only ever hope of getting a private pilot's licence, because being colourblind, I can't ever get a commercial licence, so I could never fly commercially, which I would have considered. But I remember when I went for you have to go and sit a medical before you get given a provisional licence to fly, and sitting with the doctor, and he's testing everything, joints and looking in your eye and your ear and everything. And then he says, right, we'll do the colourblind test. So he opens the book up, and he first page, and I'm like, I think it's 32. Next page, 4. And then I was like, can't see it. And he just slammed the book shut and said, right, okay, you're severely colourblind. So I'm going to put an exception on your licence. And I was like, no. So I can never fly commercially, which might be a good thing for people, I don't know.
At least you're doing something, but that's the main thing. At least you're doing bits and bobs, which is good. It's better than nothing anyway. So
yeah.
And you also spoke earlier on about your gran and the connection with the blind and partially sighted community. Can you tell us a wee bit about that?
So Gran was diagnosed several years ago with macular degeneration, and I think it was difficult for the family to sort of come to terms with a condition which cannot be reversed, and you know that she's got a type that there's just nothing they can do, and you just think how in this day and age, and I mean, we can say this about so many things, but you think, how in this day and age have we got something that can deteriorate your eyes in that way? That, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really difficult. And so she lost her vision over the course of a few years, and it actually happened so quickly, to the point where now when you go in to see her, she, you know, you have to go right into her face. She doesn't really know who you are. She wants to hold you a lot more, because I think that she's probably lost that kind of connection. So she just wants to hold your hand. And it's so difficult to see, because, yeah, I mean, her visual world is disappearing. And, you know, and nowadays you can't go in and say, oh, look at this picture, or look at, you know, Harris, my little dog's new haircut, or she just doesn't see it. And, you know, yeah, I mean, she struggled with it, and it's been difficult for the family. She ended up in a care home which specialised for the visually impaired. But unfortunately, the care home in Edinburgh and Paisley, they went bust last year, and we had to move my gran. And, you know, I think it's strange. We had these two fantastic, amazing care homes, Jenny's Well and You know, they were around and they were there for people that had visual impairments, and they just disappeared. And they had people in there that, you know, were specialised in that, and they're gone. These people have had to move into other care homes, which are not specifically made for people with visual impairments, which is a real shame. Mm. You know, moving older people anyway is difficult, but, you know, especially when she can't really see anything. She's moved to a new home, so she's not aware really of who all these people are and where she is and the different layout of the room. And so, yeah, it's tricky.
I know. And as I mean, I can totally empathise. I have a different eye condition, but it was kind of similar to me in the sense that I had sight before and I've lost it. So, you know, I can totally empathise with that feeling of going from one extreme to the other, and it is hard. And, you know, no matter what age you are, you know, you can be touched by it. And it's, as I said, I always say, and my mum and my dad have always said it as well, about how sometimes it can be harder for the people around about rather than the person.
Yes.
And it is.
It must be a terrifying thing, especially, you know, I've been able to see before, and then that just slowly deteriorates, and you know that there's, like, you know, in my gran's case, there was no going back. She just knew that, you know, I'm going blind, and that's it. And I think she found it really difficult to accept as well, that, like, why can't somebody do something about it? It has been difficult, but you know, she's happy where she is, and we just try and make the most of it, really. But she's always like, come closer. And I think, I can't come any closer. It's like, but she's now settled into her new care home and getting to know people.
That's fantastic. Glad to hear it. And the daily weather forecasts are an incredibly important thing for blind and partially sighted people, as we can identify subtle weather changes like the way that sighted people would. Thanks to you for making the weather forecast so enjoyable, interesting, informative, and all the best for your work, for your charity work, and for your flying as well. Thank you for being on Claribel in Conversation today, Sean.
No, thank you very much for inviting me along. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.